fortunately, I knew what to do. I mean, it could have hit me and killed us both. Sure. But all you do is that, close your eyes and put your nose away. You don't want any blast, because the blast can damage your rupture your eardrums as quickly as that. Well, I knew all that. But, all sorts of things. I had a...
can I just ask you, Joe, what I want to get at is, what I can't understand, because I've never seen this, is how does a human being respond when he's being...
hit?
Yeah.
Well, I could tell you, I've seen people hit and they're surprised. The look on their face of surprise. You're hit and you know you're hit, but initially all it's like that, a punch, wherever it is. If it's in your head, you don't know because you're out immediately. But if it's in your body, you're conscious. You're conscious of thinking, am I going to die? And I've had people say, oh God, I don't want to die. Oh God, they pray to God. Well, I've never prayed to anybody, honestly. I don't want to. When I was a kid, I might have done, but it didn't make any difference, you know, because I was brought up in that kind of household and church and it. But to me, it's a fallacy. It doesn't. I saw men crying. I said, "Man, I'll be all right." Walked the other way and was dead within a second. Yeah, stood up. And these things happen. I've seen people praying in London and Southampton in air raids, just the same. Didn't make any difference when the bomb fell. You're dead. Like bullets don't deviate because you pray, do they? If they're on a course. I've had bullets go by me, I've had them plough the ground up between me and others, had shells go off, kill a man like as far as me from you, right behind his heel one lad, it went all through him. And he crumpled like that. But there was an officer there who he was coming to give a message to this officer. I was a medic, he was in a Don R, and the officer was in we had an 8-inch howitzer right there, and we had a medical thing right, that was in the 1940. But when you think of it, he was killed instantly. And only because he happened to be where a shell, an 88mm shell, landed right behind his heels. And incredible, really, that they crack was like, you know, real crack. But when people are killed normally or shot, if it hits you here or the leg or out, initially there isn't any pain in anything. It's like, it's only after a second or two, the pain, the realization of pain or what happened. And if it's here you're hit, like most people would know immediately, Christ, I wonder what he's done. Because initially you wouldn't know what it's done, you know, because of the impact. A bullet is, I remember travelling above the speed of sound, a 9mm projectile jacketed. The worst thing is shrapnel. A bullet is clean because they were coated with, in fact, like I show, there's plenty of people with bullets still in them, you know, from the First World War or the Second World War, if you like, if they're still alive in the First World War, in areas where they weren't a menace. It was a bigger danger to cut them out. You damage more tissue getting them out than in, you know, and they were nickel jacketed, you know, and so basically as long as there was no foreign bodies in, or you could get clean the area, or they hadn't carried any foreign bodies in, or you had enough resistance, you'd fight any toxicity, you know, and so you were left with that. They'd leave the bullet in, like I knew a chap had one. In fact, we were running then, we'd been shot at by the Germans, not because we were medics, because we had other personnel near us, and we were running. And Bill Burton, this was in 1940, turned around and ran back, and I yelled, "Bill, come on!" And the next minute he rolled over like a rabbit, you know, the bullets were going, ploughing the ground up, and, you know, but he was one who ran back, and he just rolled over and he lay still, and I said, "Oh, he's gone." So, well, no point in going back, because we'd have been shot, you know, and we were... So we all dived through this hedge, it was three or four of us. But I remember that I heard later on, about a year later, that, you know, we were through the grapevine, that only about 60 of us got back out of about 300 on. But quite a few of those were taken prisoner. But Bill Burton, I was in York Military Hospital, it would be around the time my father died, well, around the time my brother was badly wounded, yeah. Because, and I'm in there, and... late in 42, so it was, oh yeah, I'd been there some time, but anyway, I saw this figure. We had a sort of cafeteria type restaurant. When you were on duty at certain times, you went into that because you could get your meal right away, you know, you'd be on duty on a ward, and you could go in and get a meal. You did it in turns because you didn't all go together, but I was there and sitting having a meal, and I saw this figure, and I said, "Bill," and this chap turned around, it was Bill Burton, and that was, well, over two years later. I said, "What the last I saw of you, I knew you were alive. We'd had it on a grapevine, you know, a year later. But I said, what the hell happened?" He said, "Well, I'll show you." And he pulled out his leg like that, and he had a star there, bent there, like a star, scar, white, you know, little star. He said, well, I've still got the 9mm smites or whatever, but it's still in there. He said, I said, well, you didn't move, we thought you'd gone. He said, you did the right thing, you couldn't have helped, because you'd have been shot and you might have been dead, because some people were killed. But he was one that, he said, that's a, he said, and the German, he was taken prisoner, and of course, because of this, he couldn't walk, went to a German medical unit, and they, but they wouldn't take the bullet out. And it was still there. But he, being a medic, he was repatriated after 2 years. All medical personnel were, you know, under the Geneva Convention, which most of us, a bloody evil sort of thing to do, said, well, medical personnel would be repatriated at the earliest convenience, you know, because you weren't assisting in the war, you know, you weren't part of the war effort. You were only, I mean, the first, one of the first jobs I did was a Thomas Splint, or the first Thomas Splint then I ever put on, I put one on a chap in France, a Scotsman, but we had a train smash, and going, as we went over on the ferry from here, and we got to Cannes, and we, not to Cannes, we got to Cherbourg, and we were on a train going to the south of France, or not south, down near Le Mans, and the bloody train we were, was like a cattle train, but anyway, it had an accident. We were all piled up. I ended up on top of a luggage rack, up the train, the carriage was upside down, and I was on the bottom side of the luggage rack when it was sort of time it had all settled, and I thought, me, you know, and I see, but I got out. But anyway, out of all that train, there were thousands on there. There was only one chap, and he was a medic, and he joined us to replace a lad the night before we came away. And he was a Lance Corporal, a Scotsman. And I'll tell you this story. It was incredible, this. The only injury was him. Well, I was always number one squad in our ADS, and you stayed like that. A chap, Ian Evans, oh, Dougie Gill. Dougie Gill, Taffy Brace, there were four of us anyway, and called for number one squad, because number one always went, then, when if you were doing something, number two's job then, you see. So we dashed forward, and who's this? This Scotsman, so I took his tag. I didn't even know his name, because he'd only just joined us, so I had to get his name off his tags. But I remember putting his Thomas Splinter on him, it fractured his femur, yeah, where the impact had thrown him forward somehow or other, and it fractured his femur. So he went, you know, we just dumped him off then with the French unit, somehow or other. But then we all went, got on some posh train then, real posh, I can remember it, real plush, you know, one of these Pullman Expresses going to the south of France. And we got that, and we were dropped off at Le Mans, actually. And we went to a little place outside that chateau, at a place where Beaulieu, I've been there since, and I look at it. But I often think of him, there's the first chap I put one on. The next chap I put a Thomas Splint on was a German, funnily enough, you know, where he must have been lost, or his feet, and he'd been left behind, because he'd had a bullet, a British bullet, I suppose, and fractured his femur, and he may have been out on parole on his own, or in a position, and he was left, you know, where it was very mobile, that sort of part of the war in 1940, wasn't it? Nothing to do with the Maginot Line and the other things, but it was mobile, in as much one day we're here. I spent most of our time moving, you know, from place to place, you know, you went, one day you were here, and the next, in the middle of the night, you would go somewhere else, you know, because of, there weren't many troops, most of the German columns were going south, and of course, we eventually went south, further south. Well, when we were shot up, we were only 50 miles, because I walked and ran all the way to Dunkirk myself, you know, once our unit was shot up, and there was no way, it was run, get out, we were in a farm building, long story attached to that, but you had no choice but to get out. And you couldn't go that way because there were tanks and machine guns and thousands of German column. You know, what happened was they cut off so much of the BEF. The other half of the BEF went down to the west. Like some of our lads were in the other section and only a few of us came out through Dunkirk. Most of them came out through Saint-Nazaire. They went right down through France to the west because the Germans had cut the British Expeditionary Force, the 44th Div, I suppose they were, in half or sections. You know, so, but the northern section wasn't very big, but anyway, it was every man for himself, you know. And so that was quite a colourful experience in many, many ways. Not that you're not thinking of, when you're in these positions, you only think of one person, that's you. You haven't got any choice, because the chaos was unbelievable, because all the roads were cluttered with, but I knew where north was, and I know all about boats, you know, brought back to them. In my mind was, I mean, we all knew what was happening. We knew that we were overrun. I mean, you've got that already, because we didn't even have an officer. All our officers were doctors, you know, they'd all gone. But the thing was, once we were being fired at in this farm, we didn't have, because we had ambulances and lorries, RSC driven lorries, outside this farm where we'd moved to in the middle of the night. But as we ran up this long hill out of this barn, I looked back and I could see this column. I can see it now in my mind. I could draw it actually. One side of the wood, there was part of the column, and then it came around this wood, and then there were three tanks and the rest of the column. And it was massive, you know, there must have been a German column, you know, infantry column behind the tank. And it was the tanks firing at us with machine gun and, and tank weapons. But I don't know what the shells were, but it was mostly machine gun. And there was only one thing to run us. I can think of bullets going past me now, you know, they make an incredible noise. You don't hear them unless they're close. And when they're close, it makes, I mean, if you were hit, you wouldn't know. It would be in the head anyway. But it's only when they go by your head you can hear them. And I've had them go like this, like that. It's just like that. It's an incredible noise. And that's all it is, that noise in it. And you're frightened the bloody death. And whoever you are, you say, Christ, that was flaming close, you know. And the next minute I know I was through this sort of nut hedge and dropped down beside. This is the top of this hill. We're running a big open hill, you know, no choice but to run up it to get away. But I remember going through this hedge, and Dougie Gill and Taffy Grace, I think, were two of the others. Bill Burton had rolled over. They were a stack of lads anyway. But we got through it, and the bullets were cutting the leaves off. We were lying that side down below the dip. And I thought, there was a big cornfield. And I remember coming out of that, and suddenly there were three tanks. And I thought, bloody hell, more. Anyway, whoever was there, yeah, it was Dougie Gill and Bill Thorpe, not Kathy Wright, Bill Thorpe, that's right. And we put our hands up. I said, come on, put your hands up there, shoot us, because this gun was coming around like this. And the turret opened, and they were French tanks, and they said, Bosch. And I said, yeah, Bosch, 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 everywhere, you know. And they waved, and we went on, you know, pass them. I just thought then, you know, I thought they won't have much hope if they get near those bloody things, you know. But I told them where they were. But I thought, Jesus Christ. And eventually, somewhere or other, Dougie Gill ran off. We were in a little town. They were being shelled. I mean, the Germans were everywhere, and it was being shelled. Barrages, you know, shelled. And Dougie said, well, I'm going to make a run for it. I said, well, wait till the salvos are over. We're tucked in, looking out through this house. Now, Dougie got out of the house, and he ran. I saw him go round a corner, and a shell hit the corner of the building. And I said to, that's right, Bill Thorpe, I said, I expect he's had it. Well, later on, once, you know, salvos of shells, they usually fire so many, then they leave it and they move a bit. So we then moved out and we went to the corner, but he wasn't there. But he got back. He was one who got back his own way somewhere. But then Bill Thorpe and I remember we found a Bren gun carrier. Well, the chap was dead in it. And so I said, I can drive these bloody things. Well, I had to find out how to drive it, but I did. I got it going. And Bill, but it had obviously something else wrong with it because he didn't want to go. And Bill got over this. I remember a German biplane coming, and Bill got up with a bloody Bren gun on the mounting on there. I said, you're fascinating. And I ran. And we parted there and then. I didn't see him again. I thought, they're coming straight this. But I don't know whether it did. Well, I found out afterwards it didn't, actually. This thing must have run out of ammo. It was a German biplane, not one of the monoplane things. But I thought, Jesus. And the next thing, I mean, that was in the morning, because it was early morning when we were attacked. And I got to Bray Dunes, or Dunkirk, outside Dunkirk, the next morning at sort of just after daylight, you know. So I kept going. I wouldn't stop for anything. You know, I tried a horse, that didn't like me, so I got on a motorbike, all sorts of things, you know, methods of getting running and walking, you know, trying to, you know, make up time. And eventually arrived there. So that, when I got there, it's a funny thing, on the way, I saw a truck, it was an Army 1300, right? There were vehicles everywhere in the ditches. Where they'd run out of fuel, they just pushed them in the ditch to make way for everything else going through one of these northbound roads. And I remember that thinking, Christchurch, and whatever was anything in there, because, you know, an Army 1300 weight often carried grub. They were storage vehicles, you know. And I thought there might be something in there to eat, because I was bloody starving. All I found in a shop is we'd had the window blown out in a little French village was some jelly baby things. And I can remember that's all I'd ate all the time. But anyway, as I in there, I spied a jar, and it said rum on there, like an Army jar, a gallon. I've got one down there, actually, very similar, but it hadn't got rum on it. But like a gallon of stoneware jar. And as I went to get it, these two buggers pushed me out of the way, and they were RASC blokes, and this is the truth. They said, "It's all right, poultice walloper," they called me, or something like that, and pushed me, and we saw it first. So I thought, I'm not going to argue, I didn't want to drink rum anyway, I wanted something to eat. So I said, "Oh, you're welcome." Anyway, I didn't find anything to eat, but I saw a bottle of cherry brandy. You know, a French bottle, you know, it wasn't a litre, I suppose it was 75 centilitres, and I thought, well, I'll have that. Now, I was the only one out of their squad. When we got, before this farm incident, we'd been attacked, or a mock attack by MEs, and everybody, our unit, like ambulances and trucks, stopped. And I was in a lorry that day, and I got pushed, and I fell on my head, and the next minute, one of our ambulances was up beside it, and everybody's vacating the vehicles. Well, I'm under this ambulance engine compartment then. I wasn't hurt, it just knocked me out momentarily. But everybody jumped out of our vehicles into the side of the road. It was long grass. Well, what it transpired it was a ditch, but all the grass was grown because it was in May, and, you know, which is way ahead of our time, I suppose, a bit. But they were all wet through. Now, I was the only one fully dressed when we ran, out of our little part of our, only a few of us, maybe 20 of us, in our ADS. And truly, all the others, they did pull their trousers on, but they got wet and they were drying them when we started to be fired at in this farm. So when we ran, all the time I ran and walked and whatever I did, I still had my full uniform on and a side pack, but I put this bottle of cherry brandy in my coat pocket, you see. I thought, well, I've got something, and I won't, you know, I just thought in my mind, I've got something, you know. But went on and all through the night, and you would never believe we got out to Dunkirk, or I did. I mean, there weren't many people where I was. I mean, a lot of people were way ahead of us, which I didn't know. But when I got out there, I got to Prague, who do I bump into? These bloody RAS2 blokes, you see, and they're this jar. Oh, it's that same bloody bloke, they said, like that. And I said, "Christ, haven't you drunk it yet?" or something. And they said, "No, we're just going to try it." And this is the truth. They got the cork out. They should have realised it wasn't sealed. And they tip it out. And the one kept tipping. There was fuck all in it. This is the truth. And I'm laughing like this. They're there, you see. Now, the sea's there. And Bray Dunes there. And Dunkirk Harbour's there. All alike, you know. Or the petrol installation. You know, like our refinery here. So I wouldn't go near that. It was obvious they'd been bombing it. And it was bloody chaos to go into a town. Anyway, I headed north where I knew the beach would be. The next thing was, I'm laughing at them, you see, and they threw this thing and said, you know, F to it. But I stepped backward laughing and said, well, I've got mine, or whatever, I patted it like that, or whichever pocket was in. I stepped back like this, and there was a curb under the sand off Brady, it was all sand. The road came like that, and it turned round and then went along towards Dunkirk, you see, that way. But the dunes were just like sandwich marshes, and just one mass of sand as far as you look. It's something like Sandwich Bay. And I stepped back and I fell on the fucking bottom and it broke, and then it was their turn to laugh. But if you put that in a film, people would think you were telling a yarn, wouldn't they? But it was an absolute fact. I told my kids, and they think I'm joking, but I'm not. I said, no, it's the reality of a situation. So I get up on the top, and remember, I'm a medic, and I've got a white band on with a red cross, and there's a matlow there. There were matlows. There were thousands of troops all along Bray Dunes. Thousands of them. You know, black with the poor fuckers. But there was a pall of smoke over there, black oil smoke from the refinery. Fortunately, the winds must have been southwesterly or somewhere that western direction to blow it that northward, you see, or northeastward. So anyway, I remember this matlow say, "Over there, join that log, okay?" I said, "No, I'm a medic. I'm nothing to do with them. I've got to go out here." What I'd seen, there was a little pier there, and there was a boat, a little concrete pier, and there was a boat coming in, like one of the old cross-channel ferries, not like these big things now, what we used to have. Anyway, "Oh, okay, medic, okay, yeah." And so I walked on towards this jetty, but the next thing is screaming down through came a, whatever, an ME, I suppose, and it dropped a bomb and it hit this pier. It was intended for the boat, but it was coming out of the smoke, you know what I mean? It was bad, and I was being fired at from this boat anyway. But the bomb hit the pier and put a fucking hole in it. You know, I threw myself flat. You know, and there was a bomb coming. But I had to go back to this matlow. There was a pile of stretchers there. And I got him to come with me and a couple more lads, and we bridged this hole with these stretchers, tied them together. And the next minute, this boat's alongside. It was empty, apart from a military crew. And there was an army chap, and but I always wore a tie because I was a medic. I always had my battle dress on, I had my coat on, but I always wore a tie. When I, the army used to raise hell with me, but I didn't care about it. I said, I'm a medic, I am not a soldier, and I'm wearing this bloody tie. You can please put them through. So anyway, they got used to me. Yeah, they had to put up with it. I didn't mind. I said, and I would quite happily do my job. I didn't want any fucker telling me what to do. No, I said, I don't need that. I even had an officer. I can see him. We were being shelled in a place, and he said, get in that trench, Smelling. I said, you mind your own fucking business. I said, I'm looking after my life. I don't need you to tell me how to look after it. Because the fucking trench was full of water, and everybody was in there crouching in water. I said, and I thought, and he pulled his revolver out. He said, I'll use this. It's been used before. I said, who do you think you are, Tom Mix? And all these lads there laughed, you see, and took him. I can see his face, Huddleston, yeah, that cunt, he was a cunt. He was one who did come back to the UK. He's one they should have kept there, the fuck pig. But anyway, this is before this, us running away. But I often think of his face now. I had a chance to say something to him in Canterbury afterwards, yeah, when we reformed. But I got the unit blown up in the end because they were all corrupt, our people, our colonel. We had some wicked fuckers. I got them written off. They disbanded the whole unit. I went to Sheerness. And I was doing psychiatric nursing then in Charing near Canterbury in the St. Augustine's. It's a giant neurological and psychiatric centre. It was pre-war, you know. They've just closed it now. I don't know why. This new Mrs. Bottomley, she hasn't. It's government policy. She's only a mouthpiece. But they've closed it, and it was a marvellous place. It was really. I mean, it was equipped for psychiatric patients. We had closed wards, you know, barred windows, everything, but they couldn't get out. We had belts with keys on your steel belt, padlocked on, you know, so that you couldn't take it off, you see what I mean? I mean, we had to deal with all sorts of people, you know. But that's another story there, but that's the story of my life, yeah. But in my life, I...
Corrupt, you see, you mentioned the word corrupt. What was corrupt?
Well, I found out when we were...